Podcast. Welcome to the Almost Perfect Podcast, a celebration of fuck-ups, failures, and falling flat on your face. This is a podcast that believes you can learn from experience, but that experience doesn't have to be your own. Ha, I'm but perfect and I'm a functional fuck-up. Let's learn from somebody else's mistakes. And today we are learning from Spook Mutombo, aka Ntato Mokgatha, who is a musician, a filmmaker, a journalist, and a historian of sorts. But he's also one of my all-time favorite artists, definitely one of my all-time favorite musicians, and someone who I think has been incredibly important to the South African music scene over the years, especially with his documentary Future Sound of Mzansi, that I think is still really important and something you should check out. But personally, I heard Spook for the first time on The Fantastic Kill when I was in my early 20s, and ever since then I have kept track of what he's doing. I really loved Mshini Wam. I love all his fucking collaborative projects, man. I've actually still got the Sweat X EP / album on my computer, which was not a thing that was very widely distributed, but yeah, something I still play from time to time. And fucking love Phantasma. Phantasma even played my birthday party once, which is still fucking crazy to me, but it's, you know, everything just lined up correctly for that to happen. I was throwing the party. It was a cross-dress the universe party, so you had to basically cross-dress in space, and I think that was quite a fun little theme that we had going on. But their management or their booking agent hit me up because he saw the gig was happening. Phantasma wanted to tour, and I'd managed to secure a little bit of money from Jägermeister, so I was like, yeah, let's do that. I got 20k from them, and basically all of that money was spent on flats and accommodation and yeah, paying the band a bit of money, which isn't a lot, and that's something I'll always be grateful for and something I'll always respect, is that, you know, they actually were willing to try and make the band work. They were willing to do these gigs and get in front of people, and that's still one of my favorite nights I've ever had in my entire life. So yeah, we chat a little bit about that towards the end. And yeah, man, like I say, it's just, for me, this was a big deal, and maybe a little bit too big a deal, because to be honest with you, I was not on my best game here. Like, I think I did too much research. I think I went into with too many things that, like, I particularly wanted to discuss and wasn't necessarily as present as I should have been. There were also, like, technical issues in the beginning. You might hear, like, a weird cut or two because, yeah, my sound just cut out at one point, and that was a whole fucking mess. And then at the end, it just cuts out because of the fucking platform I was using didn't upload all of Spook's chat. So yeah, there were a few hiccups and technical issues and stuff like that. But yeah, I was trying to steer the conversation in one way, Spook was trying to steer it in another, and you know, there was a little bit of a disconnect from time to time, but he shares so much dope shit, and I feel like for the most part I just got out of the way and let him talk, and it was enlightening as fuck. So yeah, you're gonna get quite an interesting chat. A lot of history, a lot of fucking history, and some very reasonable and actionable advice. So that's coming up in just a little bit. Of course, I need to let you know that this podcast is brought to you by you, which means you can support it by going to patreon.com/almostperfect, or you can go over to the Almost Perfect website, which is almostperfect.co.za. You can buy some merch, you can scan the zapper there, throw in a few shekels into the kitty, and help keep this thing going. Cause yeah, I've got tight pants and big plans, man. this year I wanna start doing a few more of these chats, you know, a few more of the people who really influenced me growing up. And even, you know, not just growing up, even recently, there's been a few artists who I really admire. For some reason, though, their management and them themselves don't always reply. But hey, what can you do, man? Like, you know, go where you're wanted, I guess. And so I'm going to keep reaching out. So I actually reached out to Jimmy Carr's management the other day because he's coming to South Africa. And they got back to me saying he was unavailable. But, you know, you miss 100% of the shots you don't take. And sometimes you also miss the shots you do take. But every now and again, you know, the puck sneaks in. And, you know, goalkeepers are fucking big. Like, especially in ice hockey where the goals are small. So I'm not going to beat myself too much if I miss every now and again, as long as I keep shooting. But that's all I've got for you for now. I'll catch up with you at the end. Here it comes. It's the Almost Perfect Podcast with Spook Mutombo. So how are you living, Spook? Or should I say Ntato? What's the name these days?
Ntato's good. Spook Mutombo's good. It's all good. Yeah, man, I'm doing good. Thanks for having me on, Bob. How you living? How you doing, man?
Yeah, not too shabby. Like, had a weird vibe, like, in December. Just, you know, the world was getting to me a bit. But I'm back in a good headspace, and I'm looking forward to trying to do some dope shit this year. So, yeah, you've been involved in quite a big project recently. It's an anthology of African stories and that are animated called Kazazimoto. How did that come about?
Well, the project in general, Kazazimoto, came about from Triggerfish, the animation studio in Cape Town.
Oh, yeah, they've done some pretty good work.
Yeah. And I think in the past, it was kind of really just about animals in Africa, like dolphins and wildebeest and stuff. So it was important for them to do something about the people of the continent that's so populous. And they somehow got a relationship with Disney, and they asked a whole bunch of people to pitch stories. I don't know, like 100 people. There's lots of teams, and it was very competitive pitching stories. And
I think this was probably a while ago, because I did see that you wrote it with Pumlani. So how, this process has obviously taken some time.
Yeah, worked on it with Pumlani Pikoli. The process took like 2.5 or 3 years.
Okay.
And worked on it with director Terrence Neal, worked on it with Catherine Green. Mainly it was me and Catherine. And then Pumlani was involved at a stage of writing. And then we had to like keep rewriting and rewriting. So it was a very long, arduous process.
Yeah, getting stuff to film can take quite some time. But what was it like working with Pumlani at that time? Because I know he was looking to get more into film before he passed away.
Oh, it was cool. It was really beautiful. It was off the back of some video work. He was introducing us to the, VR stuff?
Oh, Snap,
VR stuff and like 360 camera stuff. And so he directed a kind of video for a group I was working on, Batu. And through that, we had dinner there, and then we spoke and, asked him to come on board for Surf Summer.
Oh, Snap. So you didn't know him that long. You just met him through other projects and then decided, damn, let's work with this dude.
No, you've known him for years. I've known him since like 2000 and back in the...
Yeah, because I know he was like on the scene in Joburg for quite a while.
No, not even about the scene. I knew him when he was in high school, like 2002.
Oh, damn.
Like long ago.
Okay, so your careers like went alongside each other basically.
Yeah, we were buddies from a long time ago. You know his brother, Lisolom Zipikot? Fuzzy Slippers, the illustrator.
I really don't, but I'm going to check him out now.
Yeah, Lisolom Zipikol is an amazing illustrator. You should check him. And there's an artist called Nolan Dennis. So they all came up as kind of the crew of friends. Even the guy who was in PH Fat, the guy called Mark.
Yeah. I still need to chat to him.
Mark was also, they're all from Pretoria. So when they were in high school, and I had just finished high school. I'm a bit older than them. I just finished high school and we linked up, made some music. Yeah.
Oh, snap. I know like a bit about your history because I watched your TED talk earlier today. So
I think that's like 2003 or something. Yeah,
I know you've evolved a hell of a lot over the years, but the cool thing about it was I got to find out, you know, you do come from like a musical family, but one of the interesting things I found was that change that happened when you moved from Soweto to Sandton and you found yourself being a lot lonelier. Could you talk me through that a bit?
What is there to say? Just moving from a place that's really, there's a lot of people, to moving from a place that doesn't, moving from a place that's quite friendly and communal to moving to a place that's quite hostile.
Yeah.
Moving to a place that feels quite safe to moving to a place that's like doesn't feel safe and is quite paranoid. So it's just a different feeling.
But I imagine like that's had quite an effect on your art over time. Like that juxtaposition of life essentially and having experienced different aspects of both.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. But I guess in the same way it has everybody in South Africa, you know.
Yeah, I'm with you there. Like, but that's one of the things I find with your work is that it does just represent like what it's really like to be in South Africa sometimes. You know, like I've connected with your stuff since I was quite young. Like I still remember hearing you on the Fantastic Kill for the first time and then being like, damn, who is this guy? But then even in your later work and stuff, you still talk about stuff like campus rape. You know, you've got that Anatomy of a Campus Rape Riot. You talk about politics, you talk about all these different things amongst like these dope beats and like songs that you can really fucking dance to. And like I do find like that's obviously like a core of South African art sometimes, and you seem to embody it quite nicely.
Yeah, is that a question?
No. We're having a conversation. Yeah.
I mean, you know, it, what you're saying and the way you're saying it seems like that is the natural thing to do, you know what I mean? I've done vacuous, absolutely meaningless, hyper-capitalist, hyper-consumerist, meaningless work as well.
Have you? And okay, I didn't realize that. Like, yeah. what sort of stuff you're talking about there?
Quite a fair share, my son. Quite a fair share. No, like too much. The point that I'm trying to make is that is the need for balance. You know, when you find yourself in a heap of just bullshit, you find the need to like, okay, you have to say something about this, and you have to say something about that. But it's also, I guess, the kind of hip hop that I grew up on, and the kind of albums that I grew up liking meant that things have to be a bit topical.
Yeah.
There's one side that is maybe later, abstract, you know, and just every song can be like every song. But I think the core of when I was 6 years old, 7 years old, 8 years old, and those first albums that I dug, a lot of them were like themes on each different song, and a very strong theme. Such strong themes that, you know, something could not even be a song. It can be an interlude, but it'll still be such a strong theme. So I think it's to be, thematic and not as meaningless or vacuous.
That's dope. And I feel like that's how, like, you've kind of approached all your projects, even like looking back to Mshini Wam. But I assume like the song Control kind of puts you on the map. And that, I think, also comes from that juxtaposition that you had of like, you know, being a bit lonelier when you were a teenager and stuff, and like listening to stuff, I would assume, like Joy Division, whilst mixing it in with more local sounds. So I don't really know what the question is, but how did you come up with Control, I guess? Because for me, like, that was also like a step up that I saw, you know, because, you know, I was here in Durban. I didn't necessarily know everything that was going on, but that was another thing of yours that I was just like, holy fuck.
Yeah, I think that's like from 2008, trying to work on pretty much discovering South African electronic music and being so excited and psyched. At some point, I went on a trip with Wad Kintuli Jones from the Antwoord, and went to Belgium, and like I went out on some other mission and met some people and just kind of had the party time. But in the club, I had this massive, crazy realization that whoa, South African electronic music is the best in the world. That I've just listened to 12 hours of a big variety of stuff, but it's absolute bullshit. We've got such exciting stuff at home. I had this wash of excitement that at home I had absolutely taken for granted. And to be honest, my taste and my interest was outside because, you know, South African stuff was everywhere. So it was whatever. And it took for me to be outside to realize that, oh, shit, what's happening at home is actually really unique, special, and banging. Like, I had to stand there for those 12 hours.
And just be bored.
Yeah, I'm not bored like that. I was trying to get over on a young lady. So I couldn't be bored. I had to pretend like I was having fun. So I was actually paying attention to what's going on a certain level, you know.
Okay, that's quite a interesting origin story, I guess.
Oh no. Yeah, so then come back home, working on stuff, started group with Richard Rumney. Richard III.
Yeah, fucking love that dude.
Moleke Mbembe. That's the group that we started with him. And the idea was we were doing an idea like a mixtape, like a freezy internet, MySpacey mixtape-y thing that we put on Mediafire or whatever. And it would be versions of foreign songs in a South African electronic style.
Okay.
So it was part of a project that had like Suicide, Speed Racer, had like some South African 80s synth pop stuff that we redid. But then Control was one of the songs. Then I released an album and put it on there as well.
And who did the visuals again? Because that was also quite striking, and I think what helped boost it internationally.
Yeah, like crazy. It was a couple of people. It was the photographer DOP Michael Cleary. It was great artist master Peter Hugo.
Oh shit! Okay.
And it was, yeah.
Damn. Okay. How did you come to work with fucking Peter Hugo?
That's a crazy story. It was in this craze of kind of rediscovering South African. I don't know. There's just a real excitement with the South African music. And also, I'd been collecting music from really young.
Yeah.
And price point and pricing was always an issue. You know, to get foreign stuff means like import, means some things can go up to 200 rand, 250, 300 rand.
Oh, I remember that. Look and Listen days and shit. Yeah.
But the flip side was a lot of the South African stuff. There was this place, I'm giving you like old man memory. Sorry.
Good,
but there's one of the music shops that isn't incredible music.
Was it Music Warehouse or one of those?
No, that's what I'm saying. Oh, it's another one. There's another one that shut down, but it came up and shut down. But its whole thing was that it wasn't as snooty about what it distributed.
Okay. So
it took from a lot of independent labels across the country and pushed and supported a lot of stuff. It wasn't as turned away. So a lot of stuff was in there from a lot of spots, and you could get like the most localized regional, from unpolished to more polished to mid-polished CDs for really cheap, like 10 rand, 20 rand, 15 rand, oh, 30 rand. Some stuff is double CDs. So it was like just like a really beautiful golden age that as a music collector all my life, this was like sweet. DJ fucking Knifey, DJ Cabbage, you know, DJ Decoda. So a lot of Pretoria stuff, a lot of Limpopo stuff, a lot of Nelspruit stuff, a lot of KwaZulu stuff, a lot of Mpumalanga stuff, some Eastern Cape stuff. Just, yeah,
damn.
A real trove of electronic music. And this is just before Kasi MP3, you know, just before a lot of stuff got uploaded. So things were still really on CD if you wanted it. if you wanted this obscure track from some guy in some, you know, rural place who's making the most banging electronic music, you'd have to have it from the CD that he's printed.
Yeah, I was out of touch with that stuff, but I was like in the punk scene and that, and you would often find, you know, one person spreading around a CD and everyone just ripping that CD. If like that was just the way like music got spread, was just through sharing and through like someone being told. Like, I know there were merch tables for us and that, but it was like a very different way to get music. But then you're talking about stuff like Kasi MP3. I know, like,
oh no, sorry, I messed up. There is definitely, they were spreading through Bluetoothing stuff, people were sharing, people were copying stuff, and there was still all the, remember when Taxi Rank would sell the MP3 CDs with like hundreds of songs? So there was also that, yeah, happening at the same time. So there was just a flood of music in the pre-streaming time.
So what I wanted to get into from that was basically, you like in the Future Sound of Mzanzi, I think one of the things that comes through there was how digital distribution really helps a lot of local acts find an audience overseas because they weren't necessarily being appreciated here or couldn't get on radio, couldn't get into these spaces, you know, like here where you could actually really be heard. And it was stuff like, you know, CDs, MP3s, or
I think it's shaky to say they weren't appreciated here. They were appreciated here, just maybe not on a large scale, but things were really strong, local,
that's essentially localized, what I mean.
Powerful scenes where people were local celebrities in their neighborhoods on the street. And in there, like I went to this place, Platfontein, in the Northern Cape near Kimberley, like an hour and a bit outside of Kimberley. And on one side, they've got a traditional Khoisan village where they present and act. And then on the other side is township, Bloemfontein. And they were moved from close to Namibia, Botswana, as a whole community by the SADF.
Okay.
They were moved, like, I think, in the late 80s, early 90s. So it's a whole community, you know. I think it's a San community specific. Then in that community, they had a banging producer. And this place is like isolated Khoisan area, but has a Kasi as well. And they have their like banging house producer. That it was really just all over this point.
So what I wanted to get into from that though was then there was this like international explosion where Europe was basically looking to
South Africa. And, I guess I was contesting,
you know, a lot of artists got
the idea that they didn't have exposure. They didn't have the exposure that meant that they're known all around all around the country.
Exactly. I mean, like mainstream exposure.
But that is quite different from other things. Like, I guess, and you tell me, in something like punk, if a group, people can be local celebrities in the same way, obviously.
Oh, 100%. And the scene, like, so I was part of the punk and hardcore scene, and we definitely had like bands that we loved, and you know, you had all their stuff and like you would go watch them when they would tour and stuff like that. But the rest of the country would definitely, if you weren't into that kind of music, no one would fucking know what it was. Like, some bands would get through to radio and that, but they wouldn't necessarily be the ones that, you know, you wanted to listen to. I get what you're saying then, that like, you know, you do have your micro scenes essentially.
I guess I'm not even talking about micro scenes, because on one side it's the clubs and it's the scenes. On the other side, in Bloemfontein, I'm talking about like daylight, there's an old lady over there, there's a goat over there, there's a little child over there, you know, the speaker's blaring. That's not a scene, that's a community, you know, that's just life. That's just like,
no,
the person is big in the area, they're the only producer in the area and they're big.
Well, what actually do you think causes that? Is that just access to, like, not instruments or whatever, but something like a laptop?
It's exactly, I think, what you stepped on and then stepped away from when you said instrument, is that in the past,
okay,
society would have that function fulfilled by, you know, whatever kinds of instrumentalists or singers or, you know, speakers or griots. But now this person has the software, has this hardware, and still fulfills the same function.
Yeah, that's interesting. what, like, one of the things I was saying that's highlighted by Future Sound of Mzansi was then how a lot of this music that was big in its own right, like in its own spaces, but wasn't something that everyone in the country knew, was then being exported overseas. And what do you think the long-term effects of that turned out to be? Because I know at the time there was always the arguments about like culture vultures and people stealing stuff, but at the same time, quite a few people did manage to get paid and make careers, you know, out of going to Europe. And I think a lot of people still look that way if they are.
You know what was interesting? Like, I should stop talking. Like, you know what was interesting about that time? I don't want to stop doing that. What was really interesting about that time was that a lot of people had no interest in going to Europe. A lot of people were, the scene here was so self-sufficient. So it was so self-sufficient, was so self-contained, and people, some people were so fully booked that they didn't even need to go. Like, there's a famous story that I saw from one side. You know this, I don't know, you know, this, there's this French guy, Techy Latex. TTC.
He's been here before, hasn't he?
Yeah. So he was trying to get, I think I'm right that it was him. He was trying to get Cleo. This is when Cleo was just smashing it.
Popping like, off, okay.
As far as beats, electronic beats, and doing a variety of stuff and just bringing out album after album after album of like bangers. And bangers in the sense that, like, I was starting to travel and I was playing them in clubs all over the world, and they would just work on system. They would just work with different audiences, and they weren't in any way structured or sounding like anything from that side. It was rhythmically different. It was sonically different. It was stylistically different, but it would bang and it would get people really hyped up on the dance floor. And, his vibe with the booking that they offered him wasn't a big money booking. It was the kind of bookings that we were taking. It was the kind of booking that people who were on that circuit were taking. But it wasn't a big money booking for South Africa's top artist, you know. And he told them to kind of feck off. He told them, no thanks. Keep your Europe. Keep your Paris. Like, I'm not interested. My schedule's full. And I'm good. Subsequently, Black Coffee got that booking, and that was his first tour, and he's been pumping ever since. But the point that I'm making is that for a lot of people, things were good here, and South Africa is that place where, in one night, the people with the top songs in one night, they'll play 8 gigs, you know?
Oh, yeah, I've definitely seen that, like, especially in December here in Durban. It gets pretty crazy. And also the July is also one of those things, like, you always perform, like, 10 gigs in a day.
Yeah. Missioning. Yeah, and so it just wasn't worth it for him at the time. But after that, then it became a big thing, and then a lot of people ended up, you know, now it's like a normal thing and a big thing to go. And like you say, for a lot of people, it became good opportunity. From Future Sound, you saw Black Coffees and Future Sound, and you see what pops off from him. You see people like Nozinja. The Goom wave wasn't even, you know?
Yeah, that became really big. I know that was like in London and fucking Italy and fucking France.
But the fuck up of it is that it's still a story of exploitation. It's a story of some European dude who is using African resources to get paid and isn't paying out. what's coming into that record label account isn't coming out. And it can be argued, that it's just £50, you know, like, oh, bro, it's just £50, blah, blah, blah. But that's not the point.
So have you heard a lot of stories like that, or have you experienced anything like that?
It's the standard. It's just normal.
Really?
Like, no one gets paid. No one gets paid ever.
Fuck, welcome to the music industry.
Yeah.
So is that why you've had to do some of the shitty stuff that you said was like a bit soul-destroying earlier?
No, that's why people... That's why advances are such an exciting prospect, because on the back, no one gets paid. It's like, yeah, let's rock, let's rock. And then it's excitement. And it's usually about the gigs. Live shows is where a lot of money will come. But to trust other people's record labels to pay you is usually not a real thing. The point that I'm making is what happened with the Groom thing, for example, is a bunch of young SA dudes come up with the maddest idea in the world. And a ton of them connect with European labels. What ends up happening is that the European label owner ends up touring more than anybody on the label. And it's just a global, global north border, visa issue that they're not allowing people to travel as freely. Whereas that person can travel freely amongst their, comrade states.
Yeah, fuck, that actually is a really good point. I know that, that's been an issue for a lot of South African artists, is just the fucking visa thing. And America, Europe, they can be very fucky with it.
The visa thing is one side, but I mean, the more pragmatic side of it is just the ticket. That to go from to go from London and then travel all over the UK, for some Groom label head over there can do that versus somebody from here to do that mission takes more of an initial investment.
Yeah.
Than some people are able to make.
But I mean, then you would say it shouldn't be on the label to bring these people out and stuff like that. But I guess they're just not in it necessarily to entirely do that. Depending on the label, of course.
Yeah, I mean, that is usually the thing. But I'm talking about, A, how sustainable it is, and B, that I actually see that the label brings out the people once or twice. But what ends up happening, really, because of what's most pragmatic, is that the label head ends up being like this curator figure and gets a shitload of gigs throughout the year in all territories and ends up being like, really earning a lot. So they're getting the money directly into their account on one hand. On the other hand, they're playing all the gigs throughout the year as an impresario as opposed to the actual figures.
Fuck. I didn't even really realize that or recognize that. Fuck. It's just another story of fucking music industry fuckery. But you've, I was going to mention, you've got your own label, right?
Yeah. But I mean, just think about it more from the side of Persian flutes. You know what I mean? There's the guys in Persia who
I don't know.
They make the flutes, they play the flutes, they're flute masters. But then there's the people all over the world who stand in the universities talking about the people in Persia playing the flutes. And obviously because they're in London already, it's easier for them to travel. So it's the same thing with
But how do we address it then?
Our electronic music business. How do we address it?
Because I mean, I assume one of those things is you taking ownership over your own music.
Yeah, I mean, it's a lot of things. One side is our government should be supporting in one way. And there are programs where they do. And there are some musicians who take advantage. Some musicians who go to the same conferences every year and get the funding every year.
Yeah, that COVID funding. Yeah.
That was needed and people,
No, I just mean some people got millions and there were some discrepancies there between people who could have really used it who didn't get and people who were probably fine without it, But yeah. I know enough people also did get, it was just a mix.
I guess, we also are part of the SACEM, the French Rights Distribution Organization. And they also did a COVID pandemic relief fund. And it's just based on, that they collect so many millions and millions that are untaken every year. That they have to kind of disperse it, redistribute.
Okay, and then what else can we do to circumvent the exploitation from Europe and getting our artists? Is it just about focusing locally?
It's about education. It's about people not it's cheesy to say it's about education and it sounds like a bullshit story, but it's about people knowing. I guess we're so desperate. In SA, that if somebody offers anything, we take it. And that's the one.
Yeah. And I mean, that's somebody, even just locally with certain like labels and stuff.
Yeah. Somebody says you're going to do this, you're going to do that. You'll just take it and it's an opportunity and you never know what's going to come out of it. And that's how everybody's approaching it. So it's even hard to say, but it's just for us all to share information and share resources. But there's definitely ways to do it where you don't have to be the exploited lackey. But a big one is gatekeeping. People talk shit about gatekeeping, but there needs to be a certain degree of gatekeeping so that...
Do you see think there's been less of that these days? Because I see that basically with the media sometimes for myself. Like, I struggle with local publications because there doesn't seem to necessarily be much quality control, and like they're just writing about everything because the people will share it and get clicks and this and that. So that's just from my perspective. Like, I just sometimes like... Yeah, we're just like a little quality control.
Yeah. For me, I mean more from the side of being able to control the scene from a home base. But in this, you know, hyper-connected digital world, the idea that you'll be able to block people from doing whatever the fuck they want is really ridiculous. So, yeah.
No, I agree with you there. Although... Yeah.
What I'm talking about when I say gatekeepers in the terms of a new South African music scene is not to sell it, is not to sell it out, is to keep the rights of it. Yeah, is to keep the rights of it as much as possible. And to if someone, some random Italian, whatever, offers you the label deal, is to compare exactly what they can do versus what you could do of releasing it yourself. With platforms being there for you to release directly, like, it's really to see what the worth is. Because the big fact is that, God forbid, you get hit by, you know, somebody's drone airplane and you're decapitated. Tomorrow, that Italian label owner is going to be taking your money for the next, you know, 40 years.
And not paying it to your family.
No, like, I'm seeing it from... Like firsthand from homies who are essay producers, have passed, were working with a lot of reputable and underground foreign music organizations. And after their passing, you know, it's just been, zip. But yeah, it's just because nobody wants to count. Counting sucks. I don't want that. I should do some accounting.
Yeah, that's when you need someone you can actually trust doing that, but that can also be pretty hard to find sometimes.
That's what I'm saying. The best thing is for young people to, at that point, gatekeep and say, okay, maybe we should do it as our own label as opposed to giving it to someone else, so that for the next 10 years of this massive song, instead of them needing to every 3 months give us statements and either tell the truth or lie, pay or not pay, we can just get paid directly.
Okay, dope. That's really actionable fucking advice,
I reckon. But then there's the other side, man. There's the slickness, you know, there's graphic design, there's the music videos, there's the bells.
Yeah, but you usually find people that can do that for you in your local scene. Like if you're in a creative scene of sorts, if you're lucky enough to be in a like hub where there are other people creating, you can always create with the people around you, which I'm sure is something you've done. I mean, I know just from early on, you know, that's...
Yeah, but let's talk about aesthetics and different aesthetics that appeal to different people. You know what I mean? I'm saying this music shop that we used to buy CDs from was the maddest, weirdest covers, the jankiest, worst names, you know, like DJ Cabbage, DJ Fork and Knife, like just really bad by all thing. But the songs and some of the songs were tragic as well. But then you'd find gems in the same project as the really terrible music. You'd find gems on the same project. So it was like a great hunt. But the point that I'm making is it might not be the same look and feel that other people may be attracted to in foreign markets, and that's what they offer, you know.
Sure.
Contemporary hip design aesthetics that can appeal to Paris, London, San Francisco, and Mumbai.
I see you've gotten some notes on your work before.
Yeah.
Oh, fuck. It does, like, one of the things I wanted to actually talk to you about is how do you feel, because you've actually seen, like, the evolution of music distribution, basically, you know, from CDs to SoundCloud, Kasi MP3, and now the Spotify, Bandcamp era. Like, what are your feelings on the state of digital distribution these days? Like, were you able to survive better before off of stuff, or, like, you know, is it better now?
Able to survive, jeez.
You know what I mean. I know you'd be all right.
No, it's that it's always sucked.
Okay.
Always sucked. No. That's not true. I think it's just about how business-oriented you are and how resourceful you are and what you want to do. You know what I mean? Like, if you're going to be someone who can sell T-shirts, then no matter what's happening with digital distribution, you'll make a lot of money as a merch person, as a design person, as a caps person, as a cups person.
Sure.
From my side, yeah, it's just doing a whole bunch of other stuff, but it's also trying not to make music for money and trying to make music for the other goals of making music. And
sure.
I don't know how we got into this avenue of the conversation. I think it's something you said about survive. But yeah, I don't think you ever want to be making music to, I guess, yeah, sometimes it's hard not to make music until you can say, yeah, I make music. I'll die if I didn't make music. I make music to survive. I'd die if I didn't make music. But I mean, yeah, I don't really know.
Well, yeah, I was just wondering. Like, I mean, that does bring up a whole different aspect of it. But yeah, just the, like, do you think you're able to reach more people now, like, through stuff like Spotify, or is it just, like, fucking you guys over?
Sorry, to backtrack into other interesting conversation that has to do
with
what you're talking about now, but also what you're talking about earlier, about that point in Future Sound of Mzansi and people being recognized internationally, and YouTube.
Yeah.
And the old YouTube. You know, like the old 2006 YouTube. 2006.
You could actually find new stuff.
Yeah. On one side, find new stuff, but on the other side, also find everything to do with what you're looking at.
Into. Oh,
As opposed to being fully misdirected just due to someone paying. Do you know what I mean? It's just a different place, a different feel. And a lot of, from DJ Mochava to Nozinja, DJ Spoko, DJ Call Me, Black Coffee, like YouTube, more than Apple Music, more than Spotify, YouTube was the one. And Spook My Tambo, YouTube was the one that broke, you know what I mean, for a lot of us.
Again, these days?
Shit, that was nostalgia. That was a long time ago. Yo, that's 20 years ago now. Whoa, 2006 is 20 years ago. Whoa.
Almost. 18, yeah.
Whoa.
Don't remind me.
Okay,
just don't remind me, man. I'm having my own existential crises about getting older, so I don't need to know that.
You need to embrace it. You need to embrace it. No, now, things are good, man. I'm stoked that the kids... Not the kids. I'm stoked that people who want to release stuff and can release stuff at a high quality, I mean, even quality, that your quality is bullshit.
Okay.
I'm just excited that people have the space to release music. It really miffs me out that, you know, like, they may earn absolutely nothing off it. But like I say, you may not need to or want to earn off your music. But the idea that it'll live on this big digital farm and the Swedish tech lord will earn quadrillions, you know what I mean? And you'll only be paid after the 1,000th play. When a lot of, like if we say micro scene stuff, may live in the hundreds of plays. And that scene may be working in those hundreds of plays, but before the 1,000 won't earn anything. And this is months. And that's like, would they say like 80% of Spotify or something like that is below that 1,000 play.
Yeah, it's fucking ridiculous.
It's just a way to pay no one. So as far as how do I feel about today and all of that, think it's sad. But I think people need to be resourceful. I think you still need to make beautiful stuff. You need to offer people things that they want. You need to be useful in people's lives. I don't know.
Cool. You're also someone who has collaborated a hell of a lot, like a large like number of your portions from like from the Fantastic Kill to SweatX to the stuff you did with Xabot to Phantasma to the Lolly Boy stuff now. What is the key to being able to, you know, collaborate successfully?
Well, I guess what's the definition of collaborating successfully?
Creating dope shit, I guess, because yeah, I'm sure there's probably been a few issues behind the scenes.
Yeah, creating dope stuff is definitely the goal. And I'd say in a lot of the groups that you've mentioned, from Badoop to Kill, Phantasma, like the Lolly Boy stuff, it's a lot of like friendship. And some of it may just be really temporary, you know. Maybe someone that I'm hanging out with a lot for a year, 2 years, or 3 years, or 6 months, or just hang out with someone for a couple of months. And out of that friendship and closeness is the ability to come up with, you know, dope stuff.
Okay.
Yeah, that was the question now about how to collaborate. I'd say it's from a closeness of friendship. I don't know.
So, well, then, I mean, I guess we can take it all the way back to when you were studying medicine in Cape Town. How did you come to be in the music scene then? How did you meet Wadi and Sabat and, you know, do fucking the Fantastic Kill, which is, you know, arguably quite a legendary album in South African music history?
I guess at that point, I wouldn't have said I was in the music scene. I would have said I'm in the hip hop scene.
Okay.
And the hip hop scene consisted of a very thriving, crazy graffiti scene, mad b-boy scene, a scratch DJ scene that Cybot was a big part of and champion at the African Hip Hop and Dawa battles. Cybot was like a big deal in scratch DJing. And he was also part of a crew called EM, Evil Minds, with used to write Void. So I was really a big hip hop corp on one side, and on the other side, a publisher and a journalist. And I started a magazine called Levitation Magazine when I was in high school.
Oh, dope.
The magazine ended up working collaboration with that club Reality Insanity and that clothing brand White Trash. Then later on worked with Faith 47, the graffiti artist, who was the designer. And we were housemates. So then got deeper in the graffiti world, being around her. Mac One was her partner at the time. Wheels is her son Kia's father. So just being around when Wheels and Simon and Cybot are also in the crew together. So just being in a really creative hip hop space of illustrators, artists, dancers, and writers, and being a writer, being a journalist, being a publisher, being, you know, super passionate. I'd say that's how I came in. But, so Cybot, how did I meet Cy? It was through, we were in high school together.
Where was that?
We were at St. John's College together.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, we were in high school together. And when I was in Standard 6, he was in Matric, I think. So we're in different houses. And he was in the line, you know, he was in the last line of his house. I was in the first line of my house. So we stood kind of relatively close together, but no relation. And then I made friends with his brother and we met. But it was only later on through the magazine and my, you know, intense nerdy interest that we met. And then even later when I told him about my ideas and my weird kind of concepts and ideas.
Because you had also been rapping at home and stuff before that, right?
not just at home, like I'd had a show. Yeah, I did a gig. There was a gig called Liquid Fusion at a venue called Horror Cafe, and I had a whole bunch of Jersey acts, the DJ C Live, and a whole bunch of local acts. Okay. So I rhymed there, just rhyming out, the occasional cipher, and trying to be as much in the community as possible, whilst being, like you saw from the TED Talk, being like really isolated. I was also trying to be as much in the community as possible. And that at that point, that meant, phoning people. Hi, is Tabo home? No, Tabo's going to be back later. Who should I say this call? Don't worry, I'll call later, So I'm like 50. It's trying to get these hip-hop heads. So then Fantastic Kill. Through Psy, I was working on just mad concept, and that was the same thing with Fantastic Kill. It was a kind of concept project. That's what we linked up on. Just trying to make a really interesting conceptual hip hop story.
What was it like working with Wadi and Psy at the time?
It was really exciting. I guess we're forgetting to say that this is after they released the seminal Constructors Corporation.
Constructors, album. Yeah. You can find it on YouTube.
Which is very, very great.
Jesus. It was like a whole comic book, like as a album kind of thing. Yeah.
So
you had already heard that. You're already into that.
Yeah. I mean, before that, when we were maybe in grade 9 or grade 10 or whatever, that Deltron 3030 came out. There's like, then I heard that Genesis album, the Carpet Crawlers. Then I was like, oh shit. Then I was listening to a lot of like Black 65, just big story based conceptual hip hop. So that was my big excitement and my big interest in working with them.
And then how did that influence your career? Do you think it's had an impact? Or like, because I mean, for me, that's just where like I found you the first time. So like, I've always wondered how it was for you.
What?
I mean, like, how did that affect your career? Did it like help you like get
more people?
Being on the Fantastic Kill?
I mean, we do some shows, did shows in different parts of the country, and because he had so much notoriety and he's this white guy in South Africa, him bringing on a young black MC for even black people and black MCs is interesting. For some Joburg people who knew me but didn't know I rhymed, it was trippy. Yeah, it was just a really interesting, great, weird part of life. I was young. I can't. Super young and stoked. Felt just really exciting to do something fun, to do something exciting, to do something different.
I guess that's kind of always been your motto, though, isn't it? Because I mean, even something like Phantasma was like just way different to like anything else I'd ever heard before.
Yeah, exactly. So when you ask what did that Fantastic Kill bring, I think it's that, to keep doing really fun stuff, keep doing really different stuff.
How do you feel about Pussy on My Mind at this point in your career? With Sweet X?
Oh, man. feel good. Yeah,
I mean, that song fucking bangs, dude. Like, I'm not gonna lie.
I think all of that Swedex really, really bangs, and was released on vinyl, but was never really digitally released.
Yeah, it was on MySpace for a bit, and I don't know how I've got a copy, but I've got.
So it's like really obscure, but it's weird and it's loud and it's obnoxious. Yeah.
But yeah, then Phantasma is like completely different. And that, like, I felt was like such, I don't know, like, I just thought like it was a fucking beautiful project. How did that come about? Because like you brought together quite a few different people, like very different artists together, and you still managed to create this really coherent sound.
Yeah, they are. How did it come about? Future Sound of Mzansi documentary that I made.
Okay.
And I was talking about being super, I guess, from teenage journalist, music journalist, and the magazine that then went into making music documentaries. And subsequently, when I was making a lot of electronic music and my interest and was DJing a lot, I wanted to make this documentary to meet some of the people whose music I was playing.
Oh,
later on, made a documentary about Vugas Tate, who is in Phantasma. So that's another person. I'd met him through, there's a lecturer from the University of KwaZulu music department called Sazi Lamini. And Sazi Lamini told us about Tamboleni Vugas Tate, the extent of that. Who played guitar, bass, violin, harmonica in Phantasma. And so that's two of the Brasa.
Zetsboko as well was on the documentary, and I wondered if that's when you had met him.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm saying. That's the spiel that I'm giving, that for Spoko, it was through the documentary. For Begi, it was through another documentary. So it was basically just picking up and meeting these crazy Avengers from these different, completely different parts of the music world. You know, one Maskandi master from back in the day, old school, and another Bra who is old school in his own way, but has been through so much. Like Spoko was with Nozinja making the Shangan Disco. So Spoko's behind the Shangan Disco. Spoko was with Mojava making Township Funk. So Spoko's behind Township Funk. Spoko produced, they did a version of Sister Bettina is made with like a Fruity Loops preset that's given to you.
Wow.
That did like an Aaliyah sample. So a lot of people had done versions. So they had a version of it that's supposedly before Sister Bettina and is a popular township like hood song. Spoko is being through, you know, enough team. Andre can't for the life of me remember how I met Andre, but
hey, Shreds.
Yeah, I can't remember how I met Andre. And yeah, we became really crazy close, discordant, messy family. we became the odd brothers.
Yeah, because it's quite a varied collective. So it was, in terms of collaboration,
I mustn't forget about Leviticus Buchanan on the drums. Mike Buchanan on the drums. Yeah. He was an absolute gnat.
Well, I mean, that's the thing. It sounds like you got together quite a few characters, because I know even Andre and Spoko are like, you know, it can be a little wild.
Yeah.
I mean, what was that process actually like, making music with those people?
It was fun. It was fun. It was really fun. It's really fun to have that brotherhood. The chaos of it is kind of like, we complain about apartheid and segregation and white supremacy and the rules, but something like Andre and Beggy tuning together the guitars, there's like an inherent, you know, cultural, musical disconnect. You know, there's a anthropological disconnect of what the guitar is. There's a tuning disconnect. And them together is like this thing that, you know, on one level, shouldn't work. It's difficult to work. And we say we want to break it down. So it gets messy trying to break it down. And we try to break it down.
I mean, that was honestly such a dope project. So I don't know if I ever, like, mentioned that, weirdly enough, when you guys played at Oppie Copy, I'd chatted to Cat Power for like ages beforehand. Just luckily she wanted to chat to me, and she asked like, who should she watch? And I was like, you need to check Phantasma out. And literally whilst I'm watching you guys, she comes and stands next to me and like what you said and was like really into it. And I was just like, mm-hmm. yeah, I was quite proud. Actually, I was like, mm-hmm. fuck yeah. So I don't know where I was going with that, but yeah, like it was one of those yeah. things where like,
that's good. That's a through ball. That's a through ball. Thank you for telling Cat Power, man.
Of course, yeah. I mean, you guys were, I'd only heard Want Your Love, I think. And yeah, but I mean, I'd known your work and I was like, yeah, fuck, I need to check these guys out. So that Opie Copy, and then thankfully, well, luckily, yeah, like, sorry for putting you in a B&B when you played that gig for me in Durban. I've been meaning to apologize for years, but we didn't have much budget.
No, it's all good.
And yeah, thanks for doing that, like, because that to me was still crazy, like that you guys were willing to come and play like a pub gig in Durban for very little money.
Yeah. Yeah. No, we were really pushing at that point. And, you know, it's trying to get fully grown men across the country can be a really arduous task.
Yeah. Being a band is quite a mission.
Yeah, but even like older dudes can be even more of a mission.
Oh yeah, hard to get a hold of.
Like, yeah, no, it's just like it's a lot. It's a lot, but yeah, that's all the part of collaboration, I guess. And like you say, there's the Money Boy project which came out in the last couple of years, and that's from just was hanging out.
Yeah, how did that come about? I mean, I wanted to get into Batuk first, but we'll talk Lolly Boy, and then if we can quickly talk Batuk, and then you can go.
Lolly Boy is like a Xhosa MC, vocalist, trumpeter, guitarist from Butterworth. On one side, on the other side, from Fos Loras. So it's like very township, Jersey raised, and then on the other side, very rural. You know, Lali means village. So Lali Boy is like village boy.
Village boy. Okay.
Like rural boy. So he... I was involved in... Do you ever hear about that Damon Albarn
project? That African project thing.
African Express. Yeah.
Yeah, I knew Muzi was on that as well.
Yeah. So that was the South African Africa Express. I had done Africa Express in Spain and in the UK and in Norway before that. Not in Norway, in Denmark. In Denmark before that. And it was a mixed, different kind of experiences. You know? Some of them were like a nightmare experience, like the worst day ever, like nightmare day, like nothing can get, you know, shitty. And then some of them were very, very awesome. And the best weeks of my life that I'll cherish forever and love forever. And kept relationships with the Africa Express people. But when they came through, I wasn't able to be a part of what they're planning. But I'd done a lot of business with Africa Express team. Their management team was managing my career at some point. So I was really connected to them. So it was linking them with different artists. And through that, linked Radio 123, which Lolly Boy is a part of.
Okay.
Then there was a track that, in passing, at that point, Spoko was really ill. And I was helping him do hospital runs. He was a part of the music program. I wasn't, and I was just there for the purpose of picking him up, taking him to hospital, bringing him back, you know, like do the hospital runs. And ultimately, I rhymed on one track just from these popping in, popping out. Then some just Cybot making beats. So like an old homie, then a Lolly Boy was also on that track. So from there, we linked up, kept chatting. He heard some tracks that I had done myself. And he was like, whoa, he really wants to feature on them. So Nomzamo was the first one he featured on, and then Emonti. Then they're like really like my mom is Xhosa, my grandmom, I was raised by a Xhosa woman, really, you know.
Okay.
So I have that real cultural soft spot, cultural sweet spot. So I was making these kind of wonky beats using either choral Xhosa sounds or traditional sounds, group sounds, really raw sounds, but putting them against quite shiny electronic synthy bits. And yeah, I was doing that just for my own personal pleasure. When he heard that, he was off to the races, and that was kind of the first Lally Boy project.
So, I mean, you guys have collaborated quite a bit, and like, what keeps that going?
I think we're trying to excavate some history. We're trying to make some new possibilities. I think there's a lot of things that have been left on the ground. When I say left on the ground, I mean there's a lot of tricks that haven't been done. You know what I mean? There's a lot of magic tricks that still haven't been explored. There's just a lot of, like, we've got an old hip hop tradition in South Africa, right? Like from the 80s, sure. From, you know, some people trace the early 80s, the mid 80s, the late 80s, but we've got like an old hip hop tradition that had come through various different sounds. But as much as global hip hop has, beat making has evolved to incorporate different local elements, we still haven't caught up fully with that. Do you know what I mean? As far as everything that, let's say, UK has done, that, say, America has done, and just A for A, B for B, C for C, as far as, like, use of gospel music, use of traditional chants, use of sports themes, use of jazz. South Africa's got a deep, long jazz tradition, like a very, very deep jazz tradition that is also very vibrant today. But that trick still hasn't really been caught as far as South African beat makers. So there's a lot that's been left on the floor. So that when you say what keeps it going, I think it's to pick up and do some stuff that just hasn't been done enough to my satisfaction that I want to hear. I dig to hear it, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, I have noticed you do like to basically put your own spin on, you know, South Africa's past, basically. Like, I know you had like that period where you did quite a bit of 80s like remixes. I think you put out a whole mixtape of it, which, like, is that, I guess, since your 20s, once you realized shit was happening at home, that's when that all started, right?
No, it's not even that. I think it's long before that.
Oh, really?
The whole idea of Spook My Tambo is a story that I wrote when I was 13, 14 for like an English assignment. And it was about a little teenage boy in the 1940s in Sophiatown who is bullied, who's left alone by his dad, is bullied by other kids and plays the trumpet and ends up burning in a fire. And there becomes this other fantastical, you know, end to the story, which is what happens. It's like this glorious fire dream that he has as he burns to death. There's like a fantastical end to the story. So my interest in South Africa's past is really like from a long time ago, and it's from the thing of like time travel. I used to have this dream when I, like, the biggest recurring dream I'd have when I was really small was about time traveling. And with South Africa, time traveling is always like a precarious idea. You know? There is no real like good old days.
But yeah, but I think the time traveling thing actually fully like makes me understand your music so much better now. Like, that's a great way to describe like how you create music. It does feel like time travel, both like to the past and, you know, the future.
Yeah, and that was just a constant dream that I would have and would end up in different places, and it would have different kind of repercussions. Some of them funny, some of them like nightmares, like some of them really tragic, and some of them would have to do with, you know, what I'm learning about in history class at school or whatever. But that's what I think hip-hop is. I think it's a technology for time travel. I think it's a way of using sound to move across time and to give a feeling, to use like old resonance, things that have been captured before, and to match them together to give new feelings, but using the old energy. I think it's a really fascinating form. And when I say like trick, magic trick or technology, I think it's very fascinating for that specific thing, that you can like go to the 20s or you can go to, you know, 2018, you know, then it's usually quite very specific.
Yeah. Fuck. Yeah, I feel you there, man. I do want to try around this off. Do you have a couple more minutes to chat a bit about Batuk and how you met Carla and how that all came about? Awesome, because I figured you might. Yeah, so how did you guys meet? How did that all come about? Because, yeah, it's quite a relationship you guys have, like both like creatively and everything else.
Well, how did we meet? This is kind of contested. We can't now agree. I had one idea on how we met, but a couple of days ago she just ripped it all apart. So I'm not sure on how we met.
How do you remember it? I'll eventually chat to her and get her side of the story.
A house party really long time ago. I remember a friend of mine, Muntla, was in a bar. I remember being an observatory in Cape Town. And I might remember a trucker cap or two being around. Like, yeah. But she says
the Von Dutch era.
She says she wasn't finished high school in that time, so it's very confusing. I don't know. So we met again in Mozambique and we just became fast friends. And she's always had an interest in music, electronic music, house music. So we just kind of linked up on that. I think she's got a interesting tone, interesting way of writing. But what I saw was a play that she did. That she's a theater maker. She's a performer. She's a director. She's a producer. So I went to see a two-woman play that she did in Joburg at... Damn, I can't remember anything today. At some theater in Maboneng, but the whole thing with it was you'd mission around. You wouldn't sit down. It wasn't a sitting down play. Like they'd do different parts of the play and you'd mission around and follow them and they'd be running. So it was like really active, weird, interactive, interesting play. And it was just the two of them, but it was... And she hadn't told me like, oh, come see my play. Oh, she was just like, hey... Come through tonight. Almost like I'm coming with her to see a play.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And it ended up being like this crazy experience. So I was like, wow, she's a really great performer. And yeah, we should do music together. So since then, we've made a lot of films together. We're working on a film project together right now. Done a lot of music together. Batuk came out. Yeah, she was in Surf Sangoma. She was in the Kizazi Moto animation as Mlindos, the gangster, the go-to gangster.
Yeah. What's it like creating with someone who, you know, you care about, like where you're dating, and like, does it create like any tensions, or has the process for you guys been just, you know, ideas come easily? Like you can finish each other's sentences kind of thing? Or is it a mix?
Working with my wife, my friend, but somebody also who is a creative that I respect and that genuinely inspires me, has cool ideas, and intellectually, like, you know, like I respect and look up to. It's really fun. Yeah, it's really fun. There's obviously a lot of tension, but I think the biggest thing about it is that I learn about myself, like with working with other people, I can, a lot of relationships with other people end invariably. You know what I mean? Or stop or whoa. But with my wife, I'm with her all the time. And so there's no kind of stop. So I have to face the thing and look at, okay, what is it? And a lot of the time I'm like, oh, Ntato, it's actually you. Whereas with other people, I can kind of run away from it and blame and point the finger, is when you're forced to really just stick and look, it's like, oh, it's actually you. Put your shit together, do better. Yeah, but how is it? Yeah, it's inspiring. It's exciting. It really pushes. It's really cool also because there's all the stuff I'm talking about is kind of like Gohan, like, yeah, we're working together. But there's also things like fear, insecurity, like just like being really scared.
Well, that's the thing about creative projects in general. So being so close to someone, I imagine, can sometimes highlight that.
And what I wanted to say was having somebody who really cares about you and is quite intimately expert at making you feel better. You know what I mean? So there's some things where it's like you have an irrational fear of doing something and you should really do it, and professionally you should do it, creatively you should do it, but you just have this irrational, childish fear. But to have somebody that you're really, really close with to be like, calm down, it's going to be fine, you're going to be great, like, let's go. That also helps.
Fuck yeah, that actually, yeah, sounds pretty dope.
Yeah, there's lots of times when I would have been happy, just like, yeah, you know, if I was just doing it not like that, it'd just be like, yeah, fine.
Yeah, because I can also see there's obviously been a maturity to your work and approach as you guys have been together. So it's cool to see.
Growing, but like we say, we just calculated 20 years, you know, and well, yeah, it's 20 years, 2004. But if we say 2006, by 2006, Fantastic Kill already felt like a while ago.
But you were always busy. That's why. Like, you've literally just constantly been creative as long as I've seen. Like, I don't know how you maintain, like, such a constant flow.
It's that thing that I was saying, that I think there's a lot of stuff that still needs to get done that I still don't see other people really doing, to be honest with you.
Okay, so until that happens, it's like all on your shoulders.
Yeah. Like for real, like the whole Future Side of Mzansi documentary thing, they weren't the documentaries coming out at the point. And then after that, there was a whole big flood of them. And really rad ones came out of, you know what I mean, that flood. But it was an important thing to do.
No, I mean, it put me onto a ton of stuff I didn't know. So thanks for doing that. Like, it was genuinely educational. And even to this day, I think it's something people can still learn a lot from.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to ask you one last question and ask everyone, and then you can get going. It's quite simple. What is a big mistake you have learned an important lesson from?
Big mistake I've learned an important lesson from. I guess I've got kind of two that are lurking in my mind. The big one is definitely to read what you're signing. Read what you're signing.
So you were talking from experience earlier.
With regards to what?
Just the European labels and, yeah, signing music over to other people.
Yeah, absolutely, man. Absolutely. I mean, I got screwed over. Coming in really gung-ho, really like enthusiastic, really creative, really resourceful, you know? And as far as being able to record music, mix music, get music produced, write the music, do music videos, edit the music videos, pay for everything and just doing it. And having a label trick me into
Yeah, so that's where shit cut out. It was just a little section of the interview, but I'm annoyed. I'm obviously bummed that you guys don't get to hear the full context there or the full thing. But basically what he was saying was he put out dope shit that he paid for, and then a label picked him up, a label that he respected and thought was dope. I mean, they even had Frankie Knuckles on the label. And they basically screwed him over by signing him and then putting all the costs on him to do it again, to, you know, create shit again, to do another music video, everything like that. He had to pay for that himself whilst they profited off of it. So, yeah, that's we kind of spoke about it earlier in the podcast. You know, it's important if you're a musician to own your stuff as much as you can. I'm sure any Taylor Swift fan probably knows that at this point. But yeah, man, it's crazy how the music industry works. I think Paramore even just got out of their record deal. Like, I think it was for 6 albums or whatever, but it was about 20 years. They signed a 14-year-old girl. I think she was 14, Hayley Williams, when she signed. It's basically a 20-year fucking contract. So, yeah, you got to be careful, man. Like, people will offer you a lot. People will promise you a lot. I even know in stand-up comedy, like, even with a lot of the, you know, Showmax or the Netflix stuff, it's not like people are getting a ton of money on the back end there. And a lot of the time, they're not even getting a lot of money on the front end. You know, we're all being sold this whole thing of exposure and, you know, being able to be seen by more people, which, you know, can have a positive effect. But also, if you're being seen by the wrong people, it won't. So, I don't know, man. It's all a fucking mess, and it's a lot of shit you're going to have to figure out in yourself as an artist as to how much you want to work with labels and stuff like that, because they're not entirely bad. You know, they do offer some, like, you know, Spook, I think, said after this, or he said it maybe earlier in the podcast, you know, they do offer you certain aspects. They do offer you promotion. Some, you know, labels are actually quite good in terms of, like, you know, getting you to tour and all of those things. But also, like he said, a lot of the time they just keep that money and lie to you about what's been sold or how many streams you've gotten and all of that thing. So I guess at the end of the day, you just got to stay woke. Yeah, so that was the podcast, man. That was Spook Matumbo and Tato Mokgatha. And yeah, I hope you got as much out of that as I did. So what's been happening this week? Very little. I'm still on my no drinking thing. It's been pretty good. Although, also, you know, having to, like I've mentioned in the past, having to, like, really stare into the void sometimes, can be a little painful. But I think I'll come through all a bit stronger. And yeah, it's been a very chilled week. I watched Gen V. I don't know if you guys have heard of it. It's the Boys spinoff. It's pretty fucking dope. It's also, like, pretty cringe at times. Some of it is a little ham-fisted. But for the most part, like, yeah, it's a murder mystery. Well, not quite a murder mystery, but it's a mystery. And it's a bit of a different take to The Boys, where, like, you know, in The Boys, everyone's corrupted. Everyone's a bad guy. Even the good guys are bad guys. But here, there's a lot more of a moral quandary. And it's people trying to do good and, you know, the world, and discovering that the world is a dark fucking place as, yeah, they come to grips with the mystery. So if you dig The Boys, I highly recommend it. It's basically like The Boys meet Sex Education, I'd say, even though I haven't watched a lot of Sex Education. It just, it's giving Sex Education. So I checked that out. And other than that, I've just been trying to spend most of my time writing as much as I can. Although, you know, try is the operative word there. A few nights have just disappeared while I was playing GTA Online, which I know I'm about 10 years late for, but it's been fun just rolling around doing some missions and, yeah, letting go for a while. But I'm in my getting shit done phase, or at least, like, trying to just build a better future phase. And so I'm trying to just spend more time writing things. I've got so many different unfinished fucking things that, yeah, this year I really want to just do it. And who knows what the end outcome of all of it will be. I know, like, for myself personally, like, you know, sometimes I get a little insecure, and that makes it harder to sit down and write, and it makes it harder to try and make shit better, because I'm just like, oh, you know, you're never gonna be good enough and all of that shit. But I gotta at least work on that negative self-talk, and I've been trying. You know, like, I'm a pretty capable dude. I've written some pretty dope shit in the past. I've written some pretty good jokes, and I'm sure there's a few more on the way. it is just a matter of persevering through the pain of the blank page, or even worse, I think. Like, some people will disagree because, you know, the beauty's in the edits or whatever. But every now and again, editing shit that I've written and just going, wow, you really wrote that, huh? Damn, you're not very good at this. But once again, gotta work on that negative self-talk. So, yeah, I'm trying, man. I'm fucking trying. And I guess that's all we can do. But I did have a dope chat last week, Friday, actually, whilst I was putting out the podcast with my friend Neil Green, the comedian. You probably heard of him. And yeah, we had a really great chat. He gave me a lot of motivation and just reminded me that, yeah, being able to do a thing like this for 5 years, even before that, something like Durban Is Yours for like 9 years, and like, yeah, you know, they might not be big money earners or these things that are majorly successful, but there is something to it, man, to persevere, to continue to just do the thing that you want to do regardless of the money, which I think is something that Spook even, you know, would agree with there. And then also, you know, without necessarily all the public adoration that other people get. But it's funny because, like, I often see myself as someone who doesn't do enough. And I think that is true. Like, I do. I think I can do way more than I do. But, hey, I've also done quite a lot. Like, and been relatively consistent. But the reality is, a lot of the time, what you've done, you know, that don't mean shit, yo. Like, it's dope that you've done that. But life's moving forwards. It's not... you don't live it looking backwards, basically. And if you do, I think you'll miss out on a lot of stuff. So it is about just continually looking forward and going, what do I really want to fucking do? And a lot of the time, I actually have the capacity to do it. You know, I have a few hours at night. And I remember Neil Gaiman even saying that he wrote Coraline 50 words a night. So if I can do that, I think in the long term, you know, if I build things brick by brick, I'll have a few houses at the end of all of it. Or at least nice walls. I'm just going to build walls in the middle of fucking nowhere. And yeah, that could be an art project coming soon to nowhere near you. And that brings us to the end of the podcast, which means it's time to shout out the titular titles tier over at patreon.com/almostperfect. Now, if you don't know, over at patreon.com/almostperfect, there is a tier. It's called the titular titles tier. It is the top tier, and it is $10. And at this tier, you get to pick your title, and I shout you out. Also, you can subscribe to the $1 level or the $5 level, and I'll shout you out the week that you do that. There are benefits and stuff, but in general, I think most of the people who support the Patreon just do it to support the podcast. Like, I've put out stuff on Patreon and it just doesn't seem like the patrons actually care or need it, but this is one of the benefits if you are at the $10 level. And it's yeah, genuinely though, I do want to say a big thank you to everyone who has ever signed up to the Patreon at any level for any amount of time. Like, there's been people who've swung me a couple bucks. There've been people who have literally put thousands of rands into this podcast as time's gone on. And that will forever blow my fucking mind. And I will forever be grateful to you guys for that. So seriously, thank you very much. And yeah, shout out to Rousseau, the storage clerk of Subtle Heresies in the Lesser Overberg region. Rousseau also, like, reached out to me earlier this week, let me know about a horror philosophy book, which I'm pretty keen to check out. And yeah, if you want to get in touch with me, you can obviously do that through Patreon, or you can just hit me up, bob@almostperfect.co.za. I'm always keen to hear feedback. I'm always keen to have, you know, discussions. Like, I don't want this just be a one-way thing. So please hit me up, bob@almostperfect.co.za. Let me know your thoughts and feelings and opinions. And yeah, I probably will get back to you. I've gotten better at that than earlier on in my life. Shout outs to Russell Grant, the Far East correspondent. Shout outs to Neil Green, the Key Grip. Shout-outs to Kron Chetty, the assistant to the regional manager. Shout-outs to Kat Jenkins, the Neville ruler of the universe, and Queen Swifty. And shout-outs to Stephen Olafia, the executive producer. Of course, I want to give a big thank you to Damien Root for the bed music you hear underneath me. Yes, that's called bed music. And I learned that when I was on radio. Also, a big thank you to him for the banging fucking intro you hear at the start of every single episode. And lastly, but certainly not leastly, shout out to you. I will catch you on the flip side.